From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the late morning of August 9, 1945, United States Air Force Major Charles Sweeney flew a B-29 bomber into the overcast sky above southern Japan. He climbed to an altitude of 28,900 feet and, during a break in the cloud cover, released his payload, a 10,000-pound atomic bomb codenamed Fat Man, which fell for more than a minute before exploding over the port city of Nagasaki. Tens of thousands of civilian Japanese died immediately.
The atomic bombs which fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki must be made a signal, not for the old process of falling apart, but for a new era, an era of ever closer unity and ever closer friendship among peaceful nations.
President Truman spoke at the Navy Day celebration in New York City in October 1945. By that time, many thousands more Japanese were dying of a mysterious disease, but journalists were barred from the affected areas, so few accounts of the suffering would reach readers here at home. In fact, the very first reporter on the scene, George Weller, wrote a series of articles that were never published until this year, when his son found old carbon copies in his home after he died. Greg Mitchell has followed the story for editor and publisher. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Who was George Weller, and how did he manage to get into Nagasaki and get the story?
Well, Weller was a celebrated war correspondent for the old Chicago Daily News. He was in Tokyo with other reporters who came in early September, and they were told by General MacArthur's headquarters not to go anywhere near Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and most of the reporters went along with that. But Weller, wanted the scoop, and so by hook or by crook, he made his way to the southern island of Kyushu, where Nagasaki is located. He got in the area pretending he was covering an old kamikaze camp and somehow wandered into Nagasaki almost exactly a month after the atomic bombing.
So he was the first reporter on the ground. The articles never made it to print. So what happened to them?
Well, he made the mistake of filing them through General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo, more than a dozen certainly over the course of 2 or 3 weeks. He thought that because they were not sensationalistic, they would get out, and they never did. He lost track of the carbons. It was an almost 60-year mystery of what was in them, what happened to them.
But the carbons were found in his home in Italy after he died, and they were published for the first time last month in a Japanese newspaper. Let me read the first sentence of the first of the four articles. It's datelined September 8, 1945. Quote, "The atomic bomb may be classified as a weapon capable of being used indiscriminately, but its use in Nagasaki was selective and proper and as merciful as such a gigantic force could be expected to be." Does this strike you as something of an odd tone for a news account from a war zone?
Well, of course, you have to remember this was at the end of World War II, and Weller and other correspondents had seen a great deal of death in the preceding years, and the atomic bomb seemed to be just a bigger blast, just a bigger bomb, because not much was known about radiation. And in fact, that's why MacArthur did not want people to go to these cities. That's why U.S. officials, starting then and going on for years and decades, did not want people to focus on the properties of the bomb that made it different.
Because they knew and no one else did.
That's right. So Weller's initial reaction changed when he actually went into the hospitals. And literally, the same day he wrote that, later in that day, he wrote a quite different account after seeing the patients in the hospitals dying a month after the blast.
Can you describe what he wrote about when he went to those hospitals and saw the impact of the bomb?
Well, he saw women and children and other civilians who were lying on the floor or lying on beds with their hair falling out with strange red spots all over them. in terrible shape. He called this Disease X because the doctors didn't quite know what it was. There were rumors about radiation. The little that people knew about radiation disease, this seemed to be it. And so he wrote about these people, and his second and third accounts that came out of Nagasaki were quite different.
And that last piece he wrote ends with a statement that Americans are due to arrive in Nagasaki to study the bomb site. And he then writes, quote, "Japanese hope that they will bring a solution for Disease X." Do you think if Weller hadn't discussed Disease X in that piece, that maybe it wouldn't have been censored?
It's hard to say because there was a clampdown on virtually everything going on surrounding these two cities. A day or two after he got there, the military brought in a small group of other war correspondents for a short tour, and their stories were then held up and were censored, and the accounts that they gave focused on the blast and focused on what had happened in the cities with no mention of dying people in the hospital.
Greg, you co-wrote a book titled Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. What was most remarkable for you when you read these accounts for the first time?
Well, I think it was how Weller himself symbolized or represented the whole American and world experience with the bomb. There was his initial elation, in a way, seeing the effects of the bomb and how it may have produced the end of the war, and it was almost triumphal. But then when he learned, and then later the world learned, of the very special properties of this bomb and the fact that its poisons could be spread for many miles and even threaten the end of the world eventually, he had a very different outlook. He never became a real anti-nuker, but his whole experience, just in a little nutshell there in a few days, really captured a lot of what the American experience was in responding to the bomb.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell is editor of the Newspaper Industry Journal, editor and publisher.
Weller's accounts languished in storage until this year, but the New York Times had its own reporter on the atomic beat. William L. Lawrence wasn't ever on the ground in Japan. Instead, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer was a proto-embed, flying above Japan when the bomb called Fat Man was dropped on Nagasaki. It was extraordinary access, and Lawrence had also observed the atomic bomb's manufacture and testing. His 10-part series profiling the bomb would win him and the Times a Pulitzer Prize in 1946. But until the bombs fell, Lawrence protected another piece of intelligence. He had been on the payroll of the U.S. War Department. David Goodman wrote about Lawrence in Exception to the Rulers, a book he co-authored with his sister Amy. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Who was William L. Lawrence?
Lawrence was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. He was a science reporter for the Times. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1937, and he became a staunch advocate of the atomic bomb long before the atomic bomb was ever dropped. Throughout the 1930s, he was advocating for research into the use of atomic power, such that he earned a nickname, Atomic Bill.
So when the War Department was looking explicitly for a working newspaperman to help mold public opinion about the bomb, natural choice.
Indeed. General Leslie Groves was the military director of the Manhattan Project, scientists who researched and created the bomb. His own words were that he was looking for a, quote, suitable newspaperman to tell the story of the bomb to the public, to put the language of this arcane science into lay people's terms. So in March 1945, there was an extraordinary secret meeting held at the offices of the New York Times in which General Groves came to meet with William Lawrence and ask that he become a special consultant to the War Department.
David, there is one brief passage in a piece by Lawrence as he flew on the plane that was about to drop the bomb on Nagasaki. That is an astonishing window into his frame of mind. Can you read that for me, please?
What Lawrence wrote was that he felt no, quote, pity or compassion for the poor devils who were about to die. And he went further because his compassion was reserved for the bomb itself. When the bomb detonated, quote, awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the Earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being, born right before our incredulous eyes.
Now, the story goes beyond Lawrence reporting with an obvious conflict of interest about the dropping of the bomb. It gets far more sordid because when the news of radiation disease began to leak out, the War Department went into full defensive mode and used Lawrence to publish, in effect, disinformation. Tell me about that.
General Groves handpicked a group of journalists to accompany him not to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to the bomb site out in New Mexico, where the first bomb was detonated. And it was there that William Lawrence wrote what General Groves had wanted him to write. Lawrence, quoting General Groves, writes, "The Japanese claim that people died from radiation. If this is true, the number was very small." Lawrence continues in his own editorializing in the story. He writes, quote, "The Japanese are still continuing their propaganda aimed at creating the impression that we won the war unfairly and thus attempting to create sympathy for themselves in milder terms. Thus, at the beginning, the Japanese described symptoms that did not ring true."
60 years later, the dropping of the bomb remains one of the great historical controversies. What I find so stunning about this is that at the contemporaneous moment when the world had to make up its mind, the New York Times, in effect, became a propaganda tool of the U.S. government. And for this, William L. Lawrence and the New York Times were awarded a Pulitzer Prize.
That's right. And the very debate that you allude to about was the atomic bomb an appropriate response? Well, Americans really wouldn't know if they don't know the reality of what happened on the ground. In our book, we call for William Lawrence's Pulitzer Prize to be stripped. I think that this story has some very important modern parallels, certainly in the case of the Iraq War and in the case of the New York Times with the, I would say, credulous, uncritical reporting of Judith Miller, among others. Anytime we see the drums of war, we should really be looking to journalists to challenge those in power, not to become a megaphone for those in power.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Goodman is co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them.
Coming up in a minute, the history of American journalism in 9 minutes, and the conscience of journalism today.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As the Senate focuses on John Roberts' nomination for the Supreme Court, the Open Government Act, reported out of the Senate Judiciary Committee in March, sits and waits. Nicknamed the Faster FOIA Act by its sponsors, Liberal Democrat Patrick Leahy and Conservative Republican John Cornyn, it would, among other things, create an independent commission to investigate FOIA requests denied or delayed. When we spoke to Cornyn, he noted that FOIA requesters can wait as long as 8 years for action. A system this sluggish needs the legislative equivalent of Drano. Well, here's what he actually said.
What Senator Leahy, my co-sponsor, and I try to do is to provide for an ombudsman that would assist both the requester and the agency to try to work out differences, and then if all else fails, to provide for the recovery of some attorney's fees if government remained obstinate and didn't comply with the law.
These days, prying secrets from the government often requires lots of time and lots of lawyers. That process has been the singular obsession of Charles Lewis. In 1989, he was with 60 Minutes at the top of his game when he decided to pack it in. He mortgaged his house, retired to his bedroom, and founded the Center for Public Integrity. Today, the center is a muckraking assembly line, winning its investigators 28 major journalism awards, along the way to becoming the largest nonprofit investigative journalism organization in the world. It broke the Lincoln bedroom scandal during the Clinton presidency, published the otherwise secret Patriot II Act, revealed that Enron was George W. Bush's top career patron, and disclosed the no-bid contracts granted to U.S. companies in Iraq. In short, many of the last decade's investigative coups have been conducted by a nonprofit, non-news organization. We spoke with Charles Lewis earlier this year when he stepped down from the center he founded. I asked him how his peers reacted when he first left 60 Minutes.
My colleagues thought I had lost my mind entirely. In fact, when I quit 60 Minutes, the person I produced for, Mike Wallace, thought I was having a nervous breakdown, seriously, and called around to make sure I was okay. And lots of my friends thought I...
Wait a second. Was he right?
I think I was of sound mind, but it did appear rather peculiar.
Well, it must have been very liberating to be freed from the requirement to have dramatic videotape. What was your typical modus? Was it just shoe leather journalism, a lot of Freedom of Information Acts, and just the methodical gathering of data? What?
I felt that a good number of the most important public service corruption issues of our time, the media was asleep. And most of the federal government wasn't being covered at all, frankly. And so there were lots of records, millions of records, I realized that no one was reading. This was the very first center report. We found that 47% of all the White House trade officials over a 20-year period, both Republican and Democratic presidents, had left government and gone to work for foreign governments and foreign corporations, people they were negotiating against in trade deals they would then go to work for after they left government. You know, there was just never any coverage of what I just described. And so the model, in a way, was born.
So what are the tricks for getting the media's attention?
We found that numbers work. If we say that 40% of all the Pentagon's contracts the last 6 years, there were no competitive bidders, more than $300 billion given out to one company. That got print coverage, New York Times, Washington Post, Associated Press, but the networks yawned and didn't find it interesting. So,
because there are no pictures of 40%.
That's right. That part is hard for them, and they're going to get a defense contractor saying there's nothing wrong with it. And, of course, one of the networks is owned by General Electric, one of the top 10 contractors in Iraq and in the world. I'm not saying that's why they didn't cover it, but my point I'm making is it didn't stop us. We spent, you know, a lot of money and a lot of time and close to a year pulling 2+ million records to see about the competitive bidding and the contracts in the Pentagon. I mean, $900 billion worth of contracts under a microscope. No one has actually ever done that, believe it or not, in journalism.
Did you find yourself at idea meetings with your staff filtering out worthy investigative possibilities because you knew that for whatever reason they aren't going to attract the attention of the media out there?
I had the Field of Dreams approach that if we build it, they will come. I don't know who they is. Somebody will see it sometime because they need to be done. And if the Center for Public Integrity didn't do it, who's going to do it? You know, the posting the Patriot II Act. Here's a secret piece of legislation that the administration has not acknowledged they're even going to be developing. They've actually told Congress they're not developing such a sequel to the Patriot Act. We get a hold of the thing. We post it on the web. The TV networks did not think it was a story. The New York Times and the Washington Post and the Associated Press and hundreds of news outlets around the world did think it was a very important story. And so did 15 million hits on our website, 350,000 unique visitors inside of 5 days. And so you put it out there, somebody is going to see it, and at least there's a good chance it could have an impact. And that's all I need to go to work.
Let me ask you something, Don Quixote. What are your top three windmills that you've tilted at that you thought deserved far more public attention and media attention, but somehow amounted to nothing?
gosh, there are so many of our reports looking at the privatization of water around the world, looking at private military companies, the increased privatization of national security. We looked at chemicals that hurt people in America, and we looked at four systematically over 3+ years with a dozen researchers. And it showed an MO by an industry about how to evade regulation and also with litigation, how to seal all the court cases and keep it from the public. I happen to think that's one of the most important things we ever did. It got almost no coverage. One or two columnists tipped their hat to it.
So let's talk about success. And maybe I'm wrong, but I see about four levels. First is completing the investigation to your satisfaction.
Right.
Then there's getting media attention. Then there's getting the public to care,
right,
which does not always follow
right
from media attention.
True.
And then there's actually getting change to take place. How often have you gotten to level four?
I haven't kept score in a precise way, and the Center for Public Integrity does not advocate legislation, does not lobby. Maybe at most 10% of the time we've gotten, as you've just put it, to level four. But if I don't get to level four, that does not mean in my mind that I failed. If I got it out there and the political process is so anemic and pathetically operating these days that they can't address it, or the public is either apathetic or complacent and doesn't want to deal with it, that's not my problem. I can't do everything in the world. And if change occurs, that's like dessert. That's even better. But we eat most of our meals without dessert, I'd have to say.
All right, let me change mythic archetypes here. Never mind Don Quixote. Let's talk about Sisyphus pushing the boulder.
That might be more accurate.
Perpetually up the hill.
As
you retire from what has become your life's work, and you see the very complacent public that you've just described, and you see a government that clamps down ever tighter on information, and a media that seem in the aggregate to be more quiescent than ever, do you sometimes want to just let the boulder roll down over you and put you out of your misery?
Depends what day we're talking, I guess. I'm at a bit of a personal crossroads. You know, I'm writing a book right now. I'm teaching investigative reporting in the college level. I'm also going around the world teaching how to do it in various countries. I felt the founder had to leave the building at some point and that I needed to even go larger. I am the head of the Fund for Independence in Journalism, a support organization that will stand behind the center and groups like the center in the future. I worry about the assault on truth and the assault on information that we see today in our society.
All right. Well, Charles, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your interest. Take care.
Charles Lewis is retiring from the Center for Public Integrity, which he founded 16 years ago.
That press freedom is a fundamental principle of American democracy is practically a cliché. But we see the truth of it in Paul Starr's masterful history, The Creation of the Media. It begins when America is merely a series of colonies along the eastern seaboard and ends with the nation's entry into World War II in December of 1941. Much has changed since 1941 that this book does not directly address, and yet it has managed to overturn or at least modify every assumption I've made over the years about how the American media arrived in this form at this point in history. When we spoke to Starr last spring, he explained how the American Revolution united the patriots and the printers in a way that elevated the importance of freedom of the press.
We were the first country in the world to embody the principle of freedom of the press in our organic law, in our Constitution. It wasn't just that we guaranteed the press the freedom from government intervention. The government actually took positive steps to promote a free press by subsidizing newspapers, by creating a system of free exchange among newspapers. And you have to see this in contrast to what existed in Europe at the time, where in Britain and France and other countries, there wasn't only censorship, there were very heavy taxes levied upon the press. And so instead of taxing the press, we subsidized the press. We had more newspapers. By the time Alexis de Tocqueville came to America, he said Americans go into the wilderness with their axes, their Bibles, and their newspapers.
And your book's underlying message is that it was never mainly about the technology, and it wasn't even mainly about the marketplace, although they both played huge roles. It was mainly about politics.
Yes, I think the early considerations that dominated policy were first of all, the fear of the disintegration of the republic. How could we hold this country together? And so there were what you might call today nation-building purposes. But it wasn't just any kind of nation that the founders were concerned to build. They were concerned to build a republic. This was a system that subsidized the distribution of political news.
And it's very interesting because, as you say, it was a fragile nation, one spread out over a vast territory, and yet the politicians were willing to put up with a great deal more rancor and vilification in the newspapers they essentially subsidized than is acceptable today.
Well, they weren't entirely happy about this. Washington was attacked, John Adams, and of course, in the late 1790s, under President Adams, Congress passed a measure to try to control criticism, the Sedition Act. But the failure of the Sedition Act really set a very important precedent that, in practice, American politics wasn't going to accept that kind of control.
How did you figure out that the interview was invented by American journalists in 1860?
Well, when important people wanted to have their words in the press before the 1860s, those words appeared in the form of a speech or in the form of an essay. They didn't allow themselves to be put on the spot, asked questions that were, going to make them blurt out something they didn't want to say. And this was not done in European newspapers. So it was only in the mid-1800s that this practice began in America, and it has a certain egalitarian aspect to it. It puts the reporter more on the level of the person that's being interviewed.
Now, in your book, over and over again, you demonstrate that contrary to what I think is the popular opinion today, it wasn't the technology that pushed forward how we have our national conversation, that the ground was already tilled for that kind of communication before the technology came along.
Well, what I suggest in this book is that when new technologies come along, they provoke a political question. How is this new medium going to be handled? Is it going to be private? Is it going to be public? Is it going to be a military technology? What will be the basic purposes that it serves? And so Europe and America often dealt with the same technology in very different ways. When the electric telegraph first appeared, the Europeans treated it as a military technology. We treated it as a commercial technology. The telephone, same thing. There was a period in the 1890s, early 1900s, when there were hundreds of little mutual telephone companies, independent telephone cooperatives that were established. And telephones spread much more widely, much faster in America than elsewhere.
Why don't you give the example of how the telephone developed here as opposed to the Soviet Union?
After the Soviet Revolution, there was a choice about what kind of investment to make in communications technology. And the Soviets could have invested more in telephones. They didn't. They chose another new technology, the loudspeaker.
So everybody knew what everyone was saying and everyone heard the same thing.
Well, yes, it's a means of projecting the authority of the state.
How about distinguishing between the development of, say, the telephone and the telegraph on our shores?
The telegraph actually illustrates the American dilemma, the problems that we've run into through our history in communications. Because initially, we had a highly competitive telegraph industry with dozens of different firms. But it took only about 20 years for the industry to fall under the control of the Western Union Company, which was actually the first national monopoly of any kind in the United States. And we were totally unprepared for it. We had no antitrust law. We had no principle to deal with this new phenomenon of concentrated private power. And the monopoly of Western Union was especially dangerous because Western Union had a partnership with the Associated Press, which was controlled by a small number of newspapers.
And was America's first monopoly news service.
Right. And so together, they monopolized the distribution of national news. And they were in a position, really, to alter the understanding that Americans had of what was happening politically. And I think in the case of the 1876 election, I try to show that that monopoly helped throw the election in one direction rather than another.
So the development of the telegraph could be seen as an early object lesson in the perils of media consolidation.
Absolutely. In the late 19th, early 20th century, we saw the emergence of antitrust law, and that did help to limit the amount of concentrated control. And then when radio developed, at first there was a great profusion of different radio stations around the country, but relatively quickly again by the late 1920s, NBC and CBS had come to dominate radio. And then during the late 1930s, the New Deal began to question whether this concentrated power was such a good thing, and that resulted in the breakup of NBC, so resulted in the spinning off of ABC, and to limits on the ownership of radio stations. And of course, that brings us down to issues that are still very contemporary with us.
So, having traced the complicated path of American media up to 1941, how would you rate the balance of power between business and government and the individual today? Has it fallen out of equilibrium?
Well, I think the worries that Western Union provoked in the 19th century, the worries that the early radio networks provoked during the 1930s, are worth recalling, partly because we face those same issues today. And one of the things that I think is so valuable about the American tradition, here going back to the founding of our country, was a preference for a more decentralized system of communication that provided a tremendous amount of opportunity for new voices to be heard.
And what happened at various points in American history when various technologies got locked up by monopolies?
Well, one of the things I think that's good about the American pattern is that we generally haven't let the company or companies that dominate a prior technology from also controlling a new technology. So if you think about it, the post office didn't get control of the telegraph as happened in Europe. And then Western Union didn't get control of the telephone. And then Bell Telephone didn't get control of broadcasting. So we had competition across the different means of communication. Now today, one of the things, again, that's worrying is that, of course, the media conglomerates span different media. We don't have that degree of separation, which I think was a very healthy influence in the past.
Paul Starr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Starr is the author of The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications.
Coming up, reverberations from digital echo chambers and what reporters really don't get about guns.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, the news resounded with talk of echo chambers. According to the political newsletter Roll Call, a conference call of GOP lobbyists was hastily convened by the Republican National Committee to disseminate talking points in support of Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. The reason, according to Roll Call, was so lobbyists talking to lawmakers, staff, and media could fill the Beltway echo chamber. The Washington Post reported on a similar conference call among top liberal bloggers, which quotes Washington lawyer and gay rights activist John Aravosis. "On the left, we've always talked about the need to have an echo chamber," he said. "The left don't have that because the left don't play well with others." Every once in a while, On the Media examines words or phrases that have been percolating in the media, and we thought we would review echo chamber. It used to mean a room with hard reflective walls, a speaker, and a mic, but now it's mostly a metaphor. Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of Republic.com. He told us that the phrase can be applied to a wide array of cultural reverberations.
Sometimes what's meant by echo chamber isn't something completely new. It's like a rumor mill. And the idea is that if you have an idea or a claim about a fact that's repeated over and over again, then it will start to assume reality. But sometimes, and it might be a little more interesting, the echo chamber is narrower to some part of the citizenry. Say liberals will all hear one thing echoing, and conservatives will hear another thing echoing, and they'll be very different things. So people will, in a way, live in different social realities just because they hear such different claims about the facts.
And there are some media watchers who call this manifestation of the echo chamber incestuous amplification.
Yeah, the term incestuous amplification is often a military term, and it's used there as a warning against military leaders who keep talking to each other as if they're in a family, and then they don't watch out for things that can go wrong. And so incestuous amplification is just a recipe for disaster. That military idea has a lot of parallels for completely non-military groups like companies like Enron, where there wasn't much dissent. People were just echoing one another's optimism in a way that led to disaster. And in terms of sometimes government behavior, when there's incestuous amplification for a domestic policy that goes sour and might not have if people who lived outside the echo chamber had had a chance to speak to the people who live in it.
Let's talk about the echo chambers that you specialize in. These are the chambers that exist both small and large in cyberspace.
Yeah, the internet has many great advantages from the standpoint of democracy because people can expand their horizons. But one thing that's happened is that many people use the internet to narrow themselves so that they end up speaking mostly to people who already agree with them. So one just fact about the operation of the internet is you get these Dean supporters, for example, speaking most of the time to fellow Dean supporters. And the same can happen for Bush supporters who hear only what other Bush supporters say about the Democrats or about France. And the internet really facilitates a situation in which people are in a way living in echo chambers that they themselves have created.
And this phenomenon you've applied a new term to called cyber cascade. Does that relate to incestuous amplification, only it's on the web?
Yeah. Cyber cascades are specifically a web phenomenon in which one fact or something that's supposed to be a fact is stated to another person who then tells maybe another dozen people who then tell maybe another 10,000 others, and pretty soon people all over the world are hearing and potentially believing something that just isn't so.
At the risk of being obvious, state for the record what you think the long-term impact of the proliferation of these echo chambers would be.
The greatest danger of the echo chambers is unjustified extremism. So it's a well-known fact that if you get a group of people who tend to think something, after they talk to each other, they end up thinking a more extreme version of what they thought before. And the danger of that is you can make a situation where mutual understanding is difficult and people don't appreciate but instead demonize those who disagree with them. And that's an ongoing threat to our democracy.
So beware the echo chamber?
Yeah. If it turns out that we're talking mostly to people we agree with, something's gone wrong. And there's a kind of obligation for citizens to leave their echo chambers at least some of the time and seek out dissenting opinions.
Okay. Cass Sunstein, thank you very much.
Thanks for the questions. Great. Thanks a lot.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of Republic.com.
Ever since the last election, the media have been wringing their hands over their failure to understand how much cultural values mattered to voters. Among the most polarizing issues, gun ownership. Media tend to stereotype sportsmen, collectors, and hobbyists as raging gun nuts, and gun owners tend to see media conspiracies to repeal the Second Amendment right to bear arms. OTM's John Solomon went out in the field, literally, to find some common ground.
When it comes to gun policy, the National Rifle Association and the New York Times editorial board are usually firing broadsides at each other. Now the NRA has invited the editorial board to go shooting with them. And the Times public editor Daniel Okrent believes they should.
I think it'll be wonderful. I think it'd be a really, really good thing for the readers of the New York Times.
In a column last summer, Okrent wrote that gun owners are, quote, among the groups the Times treats as strange objects to be examined on a laboratory slide. For them, he continued, a walk through this paper can make you feel you're traveling in a strange and forbidding world.
It plays out in the paper in coverage that is not empathetic. I think journalism requires a certain empathy. You have to understand what the person's position is and why the person feels that way. And on gun issues, I feel, generally speaking, the Times writers and editors who address these issues cannot, or choose not to, I think it's more cannot, find that empathetic connection to the person who really wants his guns.
That lack of empathy is not limited to blue state media, according to Mike Needs, ombudsman of the Akron Beacon Journal. He wrote a column this past fall suggesting that journalists, even in his red state of Ohio, have a blind spot when it comes to guns.
When I walk through the newsroom and I talk about what I'm hearing from people in the community, why don't you have more hunting season coverage? The reaction is that, well, I don't think we need to do that because that's not something that they're interested in.
Needs counts only one hunter on a floor of 170 newsroom employees. That despite the fact that 4 in 10 Americans say they own at least one gun. It's a disconnect that makes this man's job much easier.
How you guys doing today? Everybody a member of the NRA?
On a recent Saturday morning, Harry Jacobs, an NRA membership recruiter, is manning the organization's booth at a gun show in the small eastern Pennsylvania town of Jim Thorpe.
Would you like to get some information? Give you $10 off and a hat.
A 58-year-old turkey hunter named Dick offers a representative opinion of what gun owners think they're getting for their $15 NRA membership fee. He believes the media are out to take guns away from private citizens, and the NRA is the only obstacle in its way.
They don't look at the gun collector or the hunter as a law-abiding citizen. I mean, I think they're working together to disarm the American public. And, I mean, that's their objective, and we need the NRA and we need the people to stick together, or that's what's going to happen.
Nearby, Kenny, a cherubic 54-year-old, has a rifle in his right hand and a homemade placard advertising its features hanging around his neck. A lifelong deer hunter, Kenny says he's never seen a realistic depiction of hunting in the mainstream press.
The fun part is the anticipation, the scouting, the family gatherings, the strategy sessions, the BSing and all those things. The going out with your brothers and family members and good friends getting together. And that's something that's never covered by the media.
Like many men here, Kenny fully supports the NRA's opposition to gun regulation because he fears any concessions will lead down a slippery slope to a complete ban. Another man says I should especially appreciate that position since no institution talks more about the potential for a slippery Bill of Rights slope than the press. He suggests I look up a 1994 Washington Post editorial which called the assault weapons ban largely symbolic, but added, its virtue will be if it turns out to be, as hoped, a stepping stone to broader gun control. To many Post readers, that may seem like throwaway boilerplate. But to gun owners, it serves to reinforce their suspicion that the media's ultimate objective is less to reduce illegal gun use than it is to take away all their guns.
It does not help when you have editorial writers make statements that appear to be hostile to gun ownership per se.
Dennis Hennigan is the legal director for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence.
That just plays into the NRA's hands, and it allows them to again reinforce their case that there is this conspiracy, essentially, against gun ownership and that they are the guardians of freedom.
In fact, research by Brian Ons-Patrick, author of The NRA and the Media, found a strong statistical correlation between negative editorials in the top U.S. newspapers and spikes in NRA membership. Ironically, Patrick says, the strong gun control rhetoric hampers the cause by alienating and energizing gun owners.
More bad press equals more NRA members. In fact, I'll put it flatly. If it weren't for bad press, NRA couldn't possibly be where it is today.
Just as helpful to the NRA as bad press is careless press. One notable example occurred 2 years ago during a live gun demonstration set up by CNN Miami bureau chief John Zarella. The story was pegged to the congressional debate on the assault weapons ban. Zarella arranged for sheriff's deputies to shoot a variety of weapons that he said would become legal without the ban.
Now that was semi-automatic.
That's
semi. Switch your automatic.
Now this is automatic.
Wow. That obliterated those blocks.
The problem with Zarella's demonstration was that the fully automatic machine gun he referred to had been banned for public use since 1934. And therefore, it had nothing to do with the legislation before Congress. Gun owners may have also found one of Zarella's questions to a sheriff to be somewhat loaded.
So, clearly, this has nothing to do with right and to bear arms. This is clearly an issue of there's no place on the street for a weapon that can do that kind of destructive power.
Several days later, CNN felt it necessary to have host Miles O'Brien issue a rare on-air clarification.
We reviewed that demonstration and decided that a more detailed report would better explain this complex issue.
I don't feel that most reporters are inherently biased. I think that there is a lack of understanding when it comes to covering the issue of firearms.
Andrew Arulanundam is the NRA's Director of Public Affairs.
It's very difficult for folks who have never fired a firearm or have no desire to fire a firearm or no desire to go hunting to understand the culture.
To gun control advocates, the press has mistakenly lumped gun control in with cultural values issues such as gay marriage. In fact, according to CNN's Paul Begala, journalists' lack of experience in the field has caused them to miss the more valid link between hunting and the environment. Begala, who has been a hunter far longer than he's been in the media, says the press portrays the sportsman vote solely in terms of gun legislation, when government decisions on the environment, such as wetlands preservations, will likely have a far greater impact on the lives of hunters.
The most powerful environmentalists I know are hunters because they see firsthand. It is not an abstraction for them. They actually spend time in the outdoors. They want to take their children to hunt and fish in the same place that their father took them.
The NRA's ability to frame the current discussion comes after years of self-inflicted media problems, according to Michael Bain, who hosts several gun-related shows on cable TV's Outdoor Network, including the NRA-produced American Rifleman.
The pro-gun side was virtually media dyslexic. We had no idea what the media wanted from us. We didn't know how to give it to them. And besides that, we thought they were out to get us.
Bain's side is now taking a more open stance with the press. He created the Aiming for Accuracy program for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, an industry trade group. It brings reporters to ranges to do some target shooting and learn more about guns. As part of my own effort to learn more, I accepted an invitation from Todd Smith, the editor of the hunting and fishing magazine Outdoor Life, to shoot sporting clays at the sprawling Orvis Sandinona grounds about 80 miles north of New York City. On arrival, I was equipped with yellow earplugs, a black shooting vest, orange protective glasses, and a brown Cesar Guarini 20-gauge shotgun. An Orvis instructor, Jim Dobbs, showed me how to hold the gun, its butt to the crook of my right arm, my face up on the gun barrel, and how to load the two yellow rounds, not bullets, as I initially called them. Before we shot, Jim previewed the arc of the two birds, actually black and orange clay discs, that would be propelled into the air one after another.
The secret with this is to look up high, pick up the bird, and always have the gun in front and under, and follow through.
I approached the wood stand, I loaded the gun, and called for the first clay to be launched.
Pull.
And shot.
Good. Follow through and under. That's
nice.
It. Beautiful.
Perfect.
I had hit one.
All right.
Actually shattered it.
Dead center.
By the end, I had fired 90 rounds total. My arms were exhausted and my cheekbone was bruised from the unfamiliar shotgun recoil. The scorecard said I had actually hit about 40% of the clays. But that was not the only surprise of the day for me. I was particularly struck by how obsessed everyone was with safety. Todd Smith from Outdoor Life said that's a common reaction of his neophyte guests.
It's not about shooting up the countryside. We went out, we were safe, we had a really great time, we had a beautiful day. And that in and of itself, I think, is a misconception that most mainstream journalists never see. I mean, you had a great time today, did you not?
I did. I even hit something.
That was also the experience at the Arizona Daily Star, one media organization that has made a significant effort to improve its gun coverage. The Tucson-based paper sent a number of reporters out shooting with expert trainers, and it held an extensive briefing on gun issues for all employees. Executive Editor Bobby Joe Buell.
We had two guys show up with hundreds of weapons, and these guys just talked about the basics of firearms. They took them apart. They allowed employees to take them apart, to handle them.
As a result, Buell says the Daily Star is now making far fewer mistakes. It also changed the nature of the paper's relationship with some of its most interested readers.
I remember a couple of months later, I was driving down the street one day, and I had a talk radio on. And I almost drove off the road. I heard one of these people who had been our biggest critic, and he's still very critical of our editorial page opinions about gun control. But he was on talk radio, and a person called in and started in on the Arizona Daily Star and our agenda and how unfair we are. And he defended us and said, you know, they make mistakes sometimes in the news pages, but I think they're really trying to get it right.
Considering the problems with the media's coverage of guns, the willingness of the Daily Star to acknowledge its mistakes and attempt to learn from them gives the rest of us in the press a nice target to aim for. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer and Josh Nathan Kazis, and inspiration from Gary Covino. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and on the iTunes podcast directory, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.